Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, and for a number of years now, he's been with us every month, always on Thursday, 10 o'clock hour, to respond to questions from people who are listening. So children's health, that's the topic, and we've talked about a lot of different things over the years. Your common scrapes and how to deal with them, and childhood illness and immunization and development issues and behavior issues, anything that you could imagine discussing with a pediatrician, well, you can do that here on the program. All you have to do is give us a call, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL or 9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, it's good to be back.
Just recently, I guess I'd been thinking kind of a little bit about shingles, which is not necessarily a childhood health topic, but just because I've known some people recently, relatively young people who had them. So, you know, you get to talk about the fact that, well, you know what this is about. Obviously, it's caused by a virus, and it's the same virus that causes chicken pox. And what happens is that when you get them, and before there was the immunization, pretty much everyone got chicken pox. You can get your chicken pox, and it was not a particularly big deal when you were a kid. And then the virus goes and hides in your body. And for some people, for reasons that we really don't know, they later manifest as shingles. And if there is any, for anybody who's had them, I guess if there is any good news, the good news is that most people only have one outbreak, and you know, that's that. So the question I find myself thinking about, and it's probably one we don't yet have an answer for, is for all of those people who, all those kids now who are being vaccinated against chickenpox, what that means for shingles. I know that in Japan they've been using this vaccine for, I don't know, maybe 20 years?
In the East it's been a lot longer than we have.
Yeah, a lot longer than we have, but maybe not long enough to answer that question. Does anybody have some thought about, you know, are we still going to see shingles in people who have been vaccinated against chickenpox?
Yeah, at least so far, there are no or rare reported cases of shingles in people who've had the vaccine. Hmm. So it seems to be protective against shingles too, although again, like you said, the vaccine hasn't been around that long, and since usually shingles is kind of an uncommon disease in childhood, we see it once in a while, but it's much more common in the older senior citizens. Okay. And the theory is that maybe their immune system is beginning to get a little senescent, and so it's not keeping the herpes zoster virus hidden in the posterior nerve roots where it's sort of hibernating, and it comes out. And so far with the vaccine, you know, we're not seeing any shingles, but it's probably too early to market the vaccine as something that will prevent shingles forever too.
The other question, and I know we've talked about this too, and maybe that's again something that we're not really sure about, is whether this vaccine confers a lifelong immunity, or could it be that some point in the future we're going to have adults coming down with chickenpox because, you know, the immunity wears off?
Yeah, and again, the vaccine hadn't been out long enough to really know, and they're looking at, you know, when the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, particularly the measles component, first came out, hey, you get one dose at 9 months, and that's going to last you forever. You're going to be protected for life. And then, well, it didn't work so well at that time, and then they kind of fiddled with the time it was delivered, and then finally they settled on 15 months, and that had to be the time. One dose at 15 months, you're safe forever. And then they found out that, you know what, yeah, for the most part people were safe forever. It seemed to confer a lifelong immunity, but there was some breakthrough, and so now the standard is two doses of measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. Just to kind of cover that, you know, that few percent that maybe it didn't, for whatever reason, it didn't take or it didn't provide full immunity, and so we'll hit them again. And with two doses, we think, and we probably are wrong here too, we'll probably have a rare person come through and break through with measles because somebody, yeah. The first vaccine was 97% effective. Okay, that leaves 3%. So the second vaccine will get 97% of that 3%. But it still leaves a small but finite number of people that probably weren't immunized with two doses of vaccine. But then the other question is, where do you stop? And so two will get 97% plus whatever 97% of 3% is. So it's coming up to 99 point some percent.
So here and there, some people are going to sneak through, and they're not going to have complete immunity. But almost everybody should.
And then the other thing you bring in is herd immunity. If everybody around you is immune, then the disease is never going to get in your circle of contacts, so it'll never reach you either. So you're protected because 99 point some percent around you is protected, and it just won't get into the population.
Yeah. So of all of those shots that we give infants, then is it still true here? We're verging into adult medicine, but the only thing that really people need to, as adults, to be conscious of is maintaining tetanus.
Diphtheria and tetanus.
The D and the T, and other than that, everything, you know, you should not. You got other things to worry about. You don't need to worry about childhood disease.
Well, I think there's one other concern is the P of the DPT, the pertussis or whooping cough. And the reason we stop giving that before school age is that the reaction to the vaccine itself used to be rather severe. Now we are not using whole cell pertussis anymore. We're using a part of the Bordetella pertussis organism, and the reaction rate is a lot less, and there's still studies going on. Can we give this to adults? Pertussis in adults is a long cold. It's a long cough. It's 6 weeks of coughing, but it has no mortality to it like it does in the under 1-year-olds. So we've got this big population out there that's liable for pertussis, for whooping cough, the adults, where it's not a very serious illness, but we would surely like to immunize them so we can protect the part of the population that's vulnerable, the young children. So with the new acellular pertussis vaccine, they're looking at that. Can we give that to adults? Can we? So when you get your diphtheria tetanus every 10 years, can we now give you DP, give you pertussis along with it, the acellular pertussis? Will it be well tolerated by adults, not cause the side effects the whole cell pertussis vaccine did? And would that be a good thing? Can we better protect our infants? And mainly what we're worried about is the under 1-year-old with whooping cough. After that, the morbidity is still high, but the mortality, the death rate is low and acceptable.
Mm-hmm. This morning here on This Part of Focus, our guest is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's here each month on a Thursday. We talk about children's health, and he is here as a resource for you. So if you got some questions, you can give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Indiana, Illinois, anywhere the signal will travel. Even if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, use the toll-free 800-222-9455. Is there much thinking about now, within the last few years, the chickenpox vaccine has been added as something that's required, about adding even more things to the list? And I guess particularly I'm thinking about hepatitis, you know, various kinds of hepatitis. And also, I guess, you know, other people are thinking about other sorts of sexually transmitted disease, things that can cause a lot of problems later as people grow up and become sexually active. What's the thought in among pediatricians about whether or not over the next, I don't know, you know, 5 or 10 years, that list of immunizations that we think all children should have is going to grow? We're going to add some things.
Yeah. I, as a pediatrician, I think one of the greatest things that's happened in medicine, and the surgeons and other specialists will disagree, they'll have their own top picks, but I think the greatest thing that's happened is immunizations. Mm-hmm. I've watched diseases disappear in my lifetime. I mean, smallpox disappeared before I got into the profession. We hope. But, you know, I guess we don't know what's going on out there. We've seen Haemophilus influenza B meningitis disappear, and that caused about 15,000 cases a year. And depends what article you read, somewhere between maybe up to 3/4 of the kids had some residual from it. So we've seen that disappear. We've certainly seen pertussis become, it still exists, but it's sort of a non-problem. You know, it's not a very frequent problem, and I think immunizations are one of the greatest things. Hepatitis B, I think why do we give it to infants when they probably aren't particularly at risk unless the mothers had hepatitis B? They probably aren't at risk. Well, we give it as infants because we got a hold of them at that time. If we wait till they're teenagers, I'm not sure we're going to get it. Where do we stop, though? How about hepatitis A? Well, I think we had that famous outbreak in Pennsylvania not too long ago where they had up to 10 people die, I think, and you say, hepatitis A, wait a minute, hepatitis A doesn't kill people. Most people who get hepatitis A don't even know they've been sick. So what happened here, and I don't think the word's out, I expect these people got a tremendous dose of the virus or something, because these were, again, some of them were older, and you say, okay, older people are weaker, and they get it, and are more likely to have a bad outcome. A lot of them were healthy adults that shouldn't have had a fatal outcome. But again, it's kind of a mild disease in most people. Do we give hepatitis A vaccine to everybody? Hepatitis C, you know, that's usually asymptomatic. You don't know you've got it. Mm-hmm. And it has it gets livers in the long run. Boy, that'd probably be a nice vaccine to have. Hepatitis C is probably treatable with interferons. You can probably reverse or slow down the infection. But interferons are very expensive treatment. And it'd be nice to, you know, for a $50 vaccine or something like that, prevent hepatitis C. But, yeah, again, I don't have any trouble with the vaccines that are out there. And I think we're getting to diseases now that have less prevalence. And where do we stop? And I don't know. And I think the main thing is, how many vaccines can we combine so we can minimize the number of injections? Or can we change the route? Can we change it to an oral route or a nasal route or to just make it easier that way? But again, you know, we've had the experience with the polio vaccine. The first one out was the Salk vaccine. It was an injectable vaccine. And then Dr. Sabin came along and developed an attenuated oral vaccine. And this vaccine was just really inexpensive. And it was great for mass immunizations because you didn't need any needles, you didn't need any syringes, you didn't need any alcohol. You just said, open your mouth, and 2 drops of the vaccine went in. But then what happened in this country is it got so the disease wasn't a great risk at all. Wasn't yet time to say, let's quit immunizing against polio. But the disease wasn't very likely, and the oral vaccine is a live vaccine, and occasionally something happens and it turns out to be a wild virus, and the people come down with paralytic polio that's vaccine related. So again, we've gone to a Salk-like vaccine, an injectable vaccine. It's a little bit safer that way, but you know, there's an awful lot of problems, questions, and national health concerns about where do we stop, what does it cost, how can we minimize injections, and is it necessary, is it going to be worth the billions of dollars invested, how many lives are going to be saved or changed, and that sort of thing. So there's an awful lot of things for these folks to think about, and I'm glad I'm not a policymaker that way.
Okay, we got some callers here. Let's talk with someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just have a few quick questions.
Sure.
My nephew is not quite 5, and this summer we want to start getting him into some kind of physical activity, organized, and he has asthma. It's mostly allergy-induced, mostly when he's already sick, you know. It gets worse. He doesn't really take medicine daily. It's more like an emergency kind of a situation. But he loves to run. I mean, he's just a little runner. He just loves to run. And so some of the ideas we had were like soccer and things like that, but we were kind of curious as to whether that's such a good idea for someone that already has breathing problems. And then the other question's more of a developmental question, just kind of how you know where to draw the line between a child's imagination and a child perhaps fibbing.
Okay, yes, yes. The magical thinking versus the flat-out lying.
Yes.
And usually five-year-olds, you know, the three-year-old is a real problem because you never know when they're in our world and when they're in the magical world of imagination. And three-year-olds, you can they'll lie through their teeth, except they're not lying because they're in their pretend world. Five-year-olds can still go in their imaginary world, but you can bring them back much easier than a three-year-old. But lying, I don't know. Can you give me a more specific?
He likes to tell stories about people at school that don't exist.
Okay. Imaginary friends are still permissible at that age.
And he gave me this or that, and there's no such person as Skylar in your school.
Okay. Does he actually have something? You know, a token, a toy or something?
Yes. Yes, one example that I'm thinking of is he had this little, it was like a tiny little book cover, and all the pages had been ripped out, you know, tiny. And it looked like a wallet to him, and he really wanted it. And he said some friend, his new friend at school gave it to him, Skylar.
Okay.
And there is no Skylar, and we're like, okay, you know, you can't keep it unless you can tell us where it came from. And it was Skylar, so.
Okay, so these are obvious untruths.
Yes.
How often does this happen?
Not too often, but if he, this is going to sound really bad, but if he thinks he can get away with it, or that, see, because like since I'm the aunt, I mean, I have him quite a bit because his parents both work a lot.
Okay.
So I'm kind of the sucker.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he thinks he can get away with it, you know, he's more likely to.
I can pull things on my aunt that I can't pull on my parents. Or
yes.
I can try and pull things on my aunt that I can't pull on my parents. And
he tries to pull it on his parents. It's just never successful.
Okay. Then I think what your obligation is, yeah, talk with the parents, see how they handle it. Make sure you're being consistent. Make sure you're both on the same beam that, hey, this is a problem. This kid is stealing.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, where did this come from? Who's it?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's something he found somewhere, but it could also be someone else's thing.
Yeah, that he
just wanted.
Yeah. And I think you and the parents need to get together to make sure that you're on the same page.
Okay.
And that you're both, calling him on the carpet to say, you know, make sure that, you had permission that you were. We're given this.
As a gift, as opposed to,
you took it and
I like
credited
it
to Skylar.
So what do you think about the physical activity?
The physical
other things like karate and stuff that he's interested in. I don't know if he'd like that, but
you know,
I just think things like soccer where he can actually get that running that he seems to love so much.
Yes, and I think, you know, what kind of allergies, what time of year are his allergies? Let's just put it this way. Physical activity needs to be encouraged. I think everybody agrees that maybe the number one health concern out there is obesity, overweight, and certainly nutrition's a part of it, and certainly exercise is part of it. And I think the other thing I can now say about asthma with the medications, with the treatments we have out there, I think no, but he should be limited by their asthma. Now, no is an absolute, so it's obviously not 100% true, but I think in general, no kid should be limited by their asthma. There's adequate treatment out there to enable him to participate in a good running sport like soccer.
Yeah, I mean, he He doesn't take any regular medication. It's more of like a February, October.
Okay.
And then we're on neb treatments and
the viral triggered
prednisone if it gets bad.
Okay.
But otherwise, he takes nothing.
Yeah.
You know? So it's mostly just when something else kicks him off, and then
yeah, cold or something like that triggers it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, soccer is fortunately a sport. You know, Ed Kieser talks about winter coming to an end. Well, how about health winter? When does it come to an end? Usually about the end of March. The viral infections are pretty much gone. And so, yeah, during the summer sports like that, he shouldn't have shouldn't probably have many viral triggers out there. And I'd sure encourage his participation. And if his asthma interferes with his participation, I think I'd talk to the doctor about a regular treatment of some sort. And probably what we're talking about now is an inhaled steroid.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's go to Aurora, line number 4 for our next. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I called about the, I think you remember my daughter got sole guardianship of a young girl, the
yes.
same age as her daughter.
About 13, as 12, I recall.
12, 13. She's going to be 13 next in March. And I would, my daughter is trying so hard to make an abnormal situation, or whatever you want to call it, normal. So she was so thrilled at Christmas time, she took pictures of the two girls together and sent them to the child's father that she has sole guardianship of. And there was no response, and my daughter was just heartbroken. And I stood there looking at her, and I didn't know what to say. Of course, I could have said, "You look heartbroken," but I was so caught up in that she was felt so badly about this that I didn't respond either.
Yeah.
What could I say to my daughter, or should I? What about that?
You know, I think I'd say, "Duh, what did you expect?" I mean, this father, if this was a adequate father, this girl wouldn't be in your daughter's guardianship in the first place. You know, if he was really a caring, able father, this girl wouldn't be in the situation she's in to be your daughter's guardian, or for your daughter to be her guardian. And I think I'd say, you know, I'm not sure what you really expected here. And probably from her standpoint, I think it may be good that this girl has your daughter as her guardian and doesn't have other parents since she was placed in this situation kind of interfering and ruffling the water, you know, making waves in the water. And I think to a certain extent she's in good shape because she's going to have less interference, because I think, again...
Oh, and I didn't think of that. I guess I was so appalled. But and my daughter's trying to make everything right, but you can't if you get a parent that doesn't want input into the child that he produced. You know, as you said, what would you expect?
Yeah. I mean, this guy was a sperm donor. He wasn't a father.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it. I wish I could say the way I felt, but I know yours program is a...
It's a family show, yeah.
It's a family show.
Well, her parents are less than adequate.
No, there's a stronger way to put
well,
it. Maybe I'll write to you.
This is on the radio. You know, they're less than adequate. That's how this girl got into this situation of needing a guardian.
And she's such a lovely child.
Yeah.
I just can't begin to tell you. And when the two girls are together, I thought possibly the listeners might want to know, those girls laugh all the time.
Good.
It is such a pleasure to watch them. I don't know what they have that much to laugh about, but I'm glad they're laughing.
Well, they probably have their their family to laugh about. How are they doing socially outside of each other? How is school going?
School is going very wonderfully.
Good.
They both made the honor roll.
Great.
The only thing that bothers me, and I don't let it bother me too much because I figure, you know, a lot of these things have to evolve on their own, and it's not a matter of life and death. But the girl that came into the family, as she's much more apt to do what my daughter says has to be done.
Okay.
Yeah, she more often, and I never know what to say. I'm glad this came up because what do I say if I happen to be there? Usually I don't say anything because I feel the situation is such that maybe it doesn't always need input from somebody else. Maybe a lot of these things have to evolve on their own. But when I see the child that came into the family structure doing more than the other child, then I just don't know what to say, and I usually don't say anything. What could I or should I?
No, I don't think so, because they're both happy. So I would say if it ain't broken, don't fix it.
That's how
and it sounds
feeling.
Like it's not broken. Or, yeah, at this time, I think the other one, the newcomer to the family, will realize one of these days that, you know, I'm getting kind of the short end of the stick here, and they will work out a new relationship. But it sounds like right now she's playing the role of the guest.
That's a good way of
putting
it.
She's working, she's working super hard. And
please.
It sounds like she's playing the role of the younger sister a little bit. And it sounds like these are probably normal roles. You know, a normal role for her to be in, and I think I wouldn't be the one that says, you know what, you're being taken advantage of, because this sounds like this is the first time she's been in a stable family, and she says this is great.
The other thing is the other child has always had her own way.
Yes.
Her mother tried to please her because she felt guilty about taking her away from her former home.
Yeah.
And the mother felt guilty, so everything was given or done that was possible. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for letting me say, and I'm going to call you next month, too. I wanted to discuss something else.
Okay. Thanks for the call. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He's on this program every month. It's always on a Thursday. Children's health is the topic, so whatever's on your mind, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455.
I have a bias against only children. I think, you know, I think it's hard for one child to raise two parents. I really think they're ganged up and outnumbered. And
so you need to have...
I think a family should be four.
Some balance
At least two kids, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that in America generally we have real concern about weight, about people being heavier than they should be. And, you know, that's probably been going on for some time now. At least there are a lot of people who like to lose weight. And from time to time, there are different approaches to do that. And right now, the thing that seems to be really big is the restricted carbohydrate diets, like Atkins. There are a lot of people that are doing that. And apparently, there are also some, you know, people who have concerns about their children being overweight. Maybe they're thinking, well, you know, this works for me, or it has worked for adults. Well, maybe we could try that with the kids. What do you think about putting children on a restricted carbohydrate diet?
You know, I guess the thing that bothers me about if you put them on a low-carbohydrate diet and maintain their calorie count, then you've got to increase protein, meat. And along with that comes fat. So you've got a high-protein, high-fat diet, low-carbohydrate diet. And I was traditionally trained that, you know, something like 60% of your calories ought to come in the form of carbohydrates, and fats and protein take up split the other 40% or so. And I think the other thing, I remember a physiology professor in medical said that weight is a very simple thing. It's calories in versus calories out. So in adults, it's how much do you eat, how much do you burn. In kids, another thing comes in there, the factor of growth. How many calories does it take for this child to grow? So I think we need to watch their weights. And I think a diet, Atkins or Weight Watchers or whatever, is not the magic thing. It's calories in versus calories burned. And so I think we need to encourage good eating habits. And I think probably we need to encourage home eating for a couple of ways, a couple of reasons. I think the nutrition's going to be better with cooking at home. And I think it's also going to promote family discussions and family togetherness time at home, which is, I think, good for a child's psychological development. And, yeah, it discouraged me. There's a billboard in town. What kind of hamburger do you want? Do you want a one-third pound? Or do you want a half pound, or do you want a two-thirds pound? And you say, you know what, there's a lot of stuff in there, and I don't care if you leave the bun off or not. There's still a tremendous amount of calories in there.
And probably a fair amount of calories from fat.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, yeah, then we're in trouble. And I think we need to encourage, like we were talking with the earlier caller, we need to encourage activities. And I think there are very few disease processes out there of any kind that you can't find some activity that this child can participate in. Mm-hmm. And certainly I will again go on record as saying that, you know, asthma should hardly ever be eliminated. I think we have adequate therapies out there for asthma, that asthma should hardly ever be a limiting factor in participating in sports. Yes, there will be intervals where something goes wrong, and you may have to lay off the activities for a few days. But for the most part, asthma is a treatable disease now and shouldn't be a life-limiting factor.
Mm-hmm. We have some other callers. Savoy is next, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about my 3-year-old daughter who is very frightened at night.
Okay.
She has a nightlight, but she thinks people are going to come in her window. Monsters will come, monsters as big as a house, and I don't know what to do about it.
I think, again, she's a three-year-old, so she can flip from the real world to the world of imagination. And I think what I do is maybe check what she's watching on TV.
She is limited.
Okay.
Once in a while, she's at other people's houses. She has seen things, and the images won't get out of her mind.
Yeah. And watch the news. Don't let her watch Osama bin Rather.
No, it's not on.
Okay. And then I think the other thing you can do is reassure her. You know, and maybe make part of her bedtime routine. You will look under the bed together. You will look in the closet together. You will check the window lock together.
Okay, that's a good idea.
And again, assure her, and then do the mental assurance. Mommy and Daddy are right next door. We'd hear it if anybody's coming in. And your window—I don't. Do you live in a ranch house or a two-story? Is her window on the second? Her bedroom on the second floor? She says, "Hey, you know what? Nobody can jump that high." And she's probably smart enough to say, well, they could bring a ladder. And you say, but Mommy and Daddy would very definitely hear the ladder thunk against the side of the house, and we'd be there.
Yeah.
Okay. So a little ritual beforehand to assure her that her room is safe, and then the mental reassurance that Mommy and Daddy are next door, and we will hear it.
Okay,
and we'll be their protector.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks.
With something like this, is there a sort of point where most children would get old enough so they would pretty much be able to say, well, okay, I know that there really aren't any monsters and I don't have to worry about that anymore. Is that a kind of a developmental stage that eventually you cross the line and you don't worry about that much anymore?
Yeah. Well, I think what happens is the monsters change. I think the furry green monster with age disappears, and it'll become and it'll change for different ages in different kids. But certainly the 3-year-old is very subject to the play world, the world of imagination.
Hmm. Okay, We have someone next in Terre Haute, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to go back to nutrition a little bit.
Okay.
My this is a very touchy subject. My sister-in-law will not cook for her four children, and it's fast food every single day unless my brother happens to be home, and then he'll cook.
Okay.
This is since my oldest niece is eight, so they're eight, six, and then four-year-old twins. She contends that there's nothing wrong with this. It's no big deal. I look at the family history and see that she had her gallbladder removed when she was 21. Her niece, who lives with her mother, and she was raised the same way with fast foods.
Okay.
She's now having gallbladder trouble at age 12.
Wow.
And I can't help but think that it has a lot to do with the nutrition. And these kids don't get anything. You know, they get no meat except chicken, and it's usually chicken McNuggets, and very few fresh fruits and vegetables. And they often, the only way they get breakfast is if my brother fixes breakfast for them, and he makes sure that he does whenever he can, but he works three different shifts.
How about boxes of cereal?
Oh, no, that's too much trouble.
Oh, my.
Although I think the eight-year-old is starting to take on, and that's just a separate issue. She's starting to take on some of the parental first, that parenting role. Mom doesn't like to get out of bed in the morning.
Oh, my. Okay. And how are the kids health-wise and weight-wise?
Well, they're all kind of scrawny looking to me. And
okay.
So
we certainly aren't worried about obesity.
Oh, no. They look like, well, they miss a lot of meals. They look like, they have a lot of times they have blue circles under their eyes. And it seems like they're all the time sick, which maybe, you know, you get four kids in the house and they're in school.
And they're all young. Yeah, the oldest is eight, and yeah.
But I mean, there's no nutrition there to speak of. I mean, it's really haphazard. If they go over to my mom's house and stay, then of course they get fed huge farmhouse meals. You know, green beans and meatloaf.
They don't care. They gobble it all down.
They're thrilled.
Yeah,
and we'll ask. Will you feed us before we go home? Can we have supper here? Or can we have dinner here? Or
how much time do you have? Can you bring nutritious snacks over to them?
And no, help the best you can? I live in a different state.
Oh, okay.
So, believe me, I would if I could. I've even considered sending them little care packages.
Yeah.
You know, from their auntie. But
you can't do that often. Yeah, it's probably not, wouldn't make a significant difference, would it? I mean, you can't do that often enough.
this is a really annoying thing, but since you brought it up, whenever we've sent leftovers, like, you know, big family dinner or something, you send over leftovers. My mom will make, like, microwavable leftover meals.
Yeah, freeze them or whatever. Okay.
Mommy will eat them, but kids will still get McDonald's or Barnes and Silvers or something.
And Dad's working three shifts. Well, yeah.
Well, Dad.
Not exactly, but he's not around.
He's not around.
Unfortunately,
as much as he'd like to be.
Yeah, he's around. Yeah, he's an active father, but he's got limited time.
He's a very active parent.
Okay. Is he your brother or is he your brother-in-law?
He's my brother.
Is he aware of your concerns?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he is.
And he's talked with his wife about this, I presume.
Right. And her response is, it doesn't matter. That's the way I was raised. And look, I'm fine.
Okay.
There's no problem with me. And their oldest child has her permanent teeth in now. And they're yellow. They're about the color of dead grass.
Okay.
And she says, oh, no, that's just genetic.
It may be. It may be that she's got a problem with dentin, with enamel formation, and it may be. It's probably more likely genetic than or lack of dental care than nutrition.
Well, she doesn't lack dental care.
Okay. Then it's,
It probably is genetic. Well, that's a relief.
It's probably genetic. And I'm not sure I guess I don't have any advice for the main, yeah, for what you're going to do with your brother's kids in another state, except
right.
worry about them. And I guess I thank you for your concern, and that's, yeah, I think.
Well, that doesn't, I understand that worry doesn't do any diddly, but.
But you know what?
I do have conversations with her, and I guess what I'm asking for is this scenario nutrition a factor that needs to be looked at more carefully?
Probably. It sounds like they're doing okay. They're scrawny, but they're probably doing okay.
Uh-huh.
And I presume they're doing well in school and all that sort of stuff, and they're active and playing and that sort of stuff, so they're probably doing okay. But gallbladder disease in 12-year-olds and 20-year-olds, the old saw we learned in medical school was the four Fs of gallbladder disease: fair, fertile, 40, and fat. So when you have 12-year-olds and 20-year-olds having their gallbladder taken out, you wonder why. What's going on? And what I think about is, do they have something like hereditary spherocytosis? Do they have, something that's causing the gallbladder to have to work too hard? Or, should they be checked out for some disease? And hereditary spherocytosis will, characteristically, it'll have mild anemia, can have anemic crises, but they have very early gallbladder disease. And if there's so many gallbladders going bad at such an early age, you say,
what's that?
Let's think about this, because maybe something else is going on, because they don't fit the usual rules for gallbladder disease.
Okay. So in a child as young as 8, is there anything they can do for preventive actions, or is there anything that they can do to do kind of a preemptive strike and then finding out that, yes, this child is a good candidate for this disease? Or?
Yeah, I think that's what we're talking about, because, you're not going to take out the gallbladder earlier if they have hereditary spherocytosis. I mean, you're not going to do it in a 4 or 5 or 6 or 8-year-old. But you're going to think about it sooner, because you say, I know this gallbladder is going to go bad. They're going to have gallstones. I know they're going to have problems. So I'm going to watch this gallbladder, and I am going to take it out before they're in agony.
Okay.
Before they have a gallbladder attack.
Gotcha. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Hi. And good luck.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, and he's on the program once a month, always a Thursday. We talk about children's health and a lot of different things. And just, as I always say, anything you can imagine discussing with a pediatrician, you can do here on the show. And I know he will give you the benefit of his experience and tell you what he thinks.
What do you do when you don't appreciate the parenting style of a neighbor, a relative, a friend? And I think we talked about with the caller from Aurora, sometimes you're best off just kind of keeping your mouth shut, because you really can't do anything. And I guess it goes back to Stephen Covey's 7 Habits. We have our circles of our circles of influence and our circles of care, and sometimes we don't have the power to really intervene, and then they become in our circles of care,
Well, it becomes tougher, I'm sure, that if you're talking about this is your nieces and nephews, this is your family, and that's although a neighbor, might be, because of proximity, might be more in your sphere than a family that lives a long, long way away.
Yeah. If they're abused and neglected, obviously you call the appropriate agency and have them investigate it. But, the kids who are living on fast food and TV dinners and that, you say, it's not my style of raising my children, but I really can't say that these children are being abused and neglected, so I can't do it. Yeah.
Maybe in a case like that, you just have to wait till the kids get big enough to say, look, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
And then maybe maybe they'll have to learn to cook themselves.
And it sounds like this 8-year-old's already doing that, saying, I want a bowl of whatever for breakfast. And the other thing is, if we go back to the data on breakfast in school, breakfast and lunch provided in school, We do have good data that suggests, doesn't suggest, it shows that these kids do better in school. They get better grades, they learn more, and that nutrition does, is important, and breakfast is a very important meal.
Well, again, we have time here for some other questions. You want to call in 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Are we, do you think we're pretty much through the flu season? I guess it is still possible for another month or more. Probably, I guess you could still get flu.
Yeah. I think specifically influenza A and B, it sounds like this year it came early. It peaked early. And it's disappearing, but we're certainly not through the myriad of other viruses out there and strep throat. I used to like to see strep throat come because that was usually the last epidemic of the winter. And when you saw strep coming, you said, "Oh, good,
spring is almost here."
Health spring is here.
Okay, we have somebody here on a cell phone. Let's talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
I was just going to make a really quick comment apropos to the last caller.
Yeah.
I'm really glad, speaking as an adult, that my mom and my stepmom, well, they cook very well for me, so I didn't have that issue. But they taught me how to cook, and that's an exceptionally useful skill. I mean, it's not something that little kids can learn how to do, although I think my mom first started explaining what she was doing in the kitchen when I was probably 6, 7, or 8 or something like that. And you know, as long as you supervise your kids, because a stove is dangerous.
Yes.
I think it's an incredibly useful skill. A lot of people don't seem to have it, particularly men. But I'm going to hang up and let you comment on that.
Okay.
I have no comment on that. I just completely agree with you. And you know, you hear of more and more men being the primary cooks in families now. And you know, whoever enjoys the task, do the task. It's not an XY factor. It's not a gender factor, and whoever enjoys it, do it. And I think certainly, all right, what do you do with a 3-year-old or even a 2-year-old? You know what? Get them a dull-tipped knife, a bread knife, and they can start making their own peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And when they're capable of pouring or put it in an appropriate pitcher, they can put milk on their cereal, and they can at a very early age, they can start getting familiar with the kitchen that way, and certainly watch whichever parent does the cooking, and be involved with wherever they can. I think it's great. I mean, who's your expert on cooking? Doyle Moore.
Well, he is the man we like to call our chef in residence.
That's right. And he's an XY. It's not gender. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not gender specific at all.
No.
And I think you enjoy cooking.
I do. Yeah, very much.
And I think
I'm with the caller. So this is a good guy skill to have. This is very important.
And since retiring, I've taken over much of it, too. I'm not sure if it's because I enjoy it or because I get hungry. You know, but anyway.
The wife says, "You're hungry? Go in the kitchen. Make something for yourself. I'm busy." Okay. Well, again, we have a couple of minutes left. You want to call in? We got some other questions. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. And something we've talked about certainly a lot of times before is dealing with the picky eater. I guess in the past, what your advice has been is at least try to offer a variety of things, a good balanced diet. And that the kids are likely to pick and choose.
Yes.
And that in a sense, that's okay as long as they don't think that you're running a short order restaurant and that they can order stuff up. That it seems that the findings are if you present them with a well-balanced diet, even if it seems to you they're on some kind of weird diet where they'll only eat 3 different things, that their bodies are somehow smart enough to know how to get what they need.
They'll take it. Yeah, they'll do fine. They'll do fine. You don't have to eat beets. There's other substitutes for them. Yeah.
Is there any evidence that shows, though, if you, say as early as possible, if you offer children a wide range of food. You just say, well, here, you know, taste this. What do you think? Yeah. That somehow their palates will be more broad-minded, or that they'll be sort of more accepting of different sorts of things?
Yeah, I've never seen any studies about that. I don't think, from what I heard in the office, I don't think that's true. I think kids' favorite food is peanut butter, grape jelly on white bread, and take the crust off. And then the taste broadened. Yeah, I think with maturity, the palate matures too, and the taste will broaden. But I think you're not going to see wide-ranging taste probably till they're adults.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess we could leave it at that for this time around and say thanks. Appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. This was my pleasure.
Dr. Robert Bocek, he's a pediatrician. He's with us on the program here once a month, always on a Thursday. And we talk about children's health.